From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. When the Nazis invaded North Africa during World War II, they also exported their anti-Semitic policies. On today's Fresh Air, the stories of Arabs who aided and protected Jews in Arab lands. We talk with Robert Satloff, author of Among the Righteous. Also, actor George Clooney. He's starring in the new thriller Michael Clayton, about the wheeling and dealing at a corrupt law firm. We'll also have a review of the film by David Edelstein. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first solo album by Texas blues man and drummer Doyle Bramhall, who previously fronted his own band, The Chessmen, and played in Stevie Ray Vaughan's band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Ken Burns documentary series about World War II, The War, has drawn the largest audience for a PBS program in 7 years. But even Ken Burns admits his account is anything but complete. And today, we examine a part of World War II history that is lesser known. Our guest, Robert Satloff, has written a book about the reach of the Holocaust into Arab lands and the fate of Jews in northern Africa. It's called Among the Righteous, and it's now out in paperback. Among the Righteous tells the story of how the German Nazis, Italian fascists, and French Vichyists applied some of the same anti-Semitic methods in North Africa that were used against Jews in Europe. The book also tells the lost stories of Arabs who protected and rescued Jews. Satloff is executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Terry spoke with Robert Satloff last December.
Robert Satloff, welcome to Fresh Air. Is Holocaust denial part of your reason for writing your new book?
It's actually the principal reason why I first started writing my book, which was a recognition that Holocaust denial is really the tip of the iceberg which separates the great cultural divide between many aspects of Arab and Muslim culture and our own. And I tried to come up with a way to access, a way for Arabs to access this so that they wouldn't be subject to the horrible spewing of the deniers. Most Arabs, I find, actually are not deniers as much as ignorant of the events of World War II, of the Holocaust. And so I wrote this book to try to find a way for them to access it in a language and in a history and a context which would make sense.
Part of what you wanted to do with your research was to find stories of Arabs who helped save Jews during the Holocaust. Why was that your angle?
Well, I very early tried to come up with a hopeful and positive and constructive way to talk with Arabs of goodwill about the Holocaust. And the first conclusion I reached is that I should try to make it an Arab story, and not just an Arab story, but perhaps a story about which Arabs could identify. An Arab who saved a Jew, if you accept and celebrate the heroism of an Arab who saved a Jew, then you have to accept the context that there was something to save that Jew from. And so in some way, I hoped that I could use this as a way to lance the boil, as it were, of some of the denial that exists in these societies.
Before we get to some of the stories you uncovered, let's just look at the map of northern Africa during World War II. Which parts of northern Africa were controlled by fascist Nazis or the Vichy government of France, which was collaborating with Germany after the invasion of France?
Well, the first observation is that most Arab countries were under European domination, under European colonialism. You had in North Africa, for example, France governing Algeria as a colony and governing Morocco and Tunisia as protectorates. They had their own titular monarchs, the Sultan in Morocco and the Bey in Tunis, but they were under French control. Libya was an Italian colony. Then Germany came to these lands directly in terms of their own occupation only in one Arab country, and that's Tunisia, for a very important six-month period in 42 and 43. Other Arab countries had their touch with European Axis powers. Syria and Lebanon, for example, were under Vichy control, but only for a brief period of time. When one speaks principally about the Holocaust's long reach into this lands, into Arab lands, one is speaking mainly about the North African experience, where Germany, Vichy France, and the Italian fascists were in control from summer of 1940, until the spring, until May, certainly in Tunisia, until spring of 1943.
There were no death camps in northern Africa, but there were labor camps.
Yes.
What did you learn about those labor camps?
Yes, this is one aspect of the story that, you know, I had no idea existed. There were over 100 slave and forced labor camps in Arab lands. 100 spread out from Morocco on the west through Libya on the east. Now, these were called concentration camps by the French and by the Germans who established them. And matter of fact, what we tend to forget is the first concentration camps ever liberated by the Allies were these, the ones in Arab lands in 1942. There were torture camps, what the French themselves called punishment camps. Sometimes these were for Jews in local Arab lands, the ones in Tunisia especially, and in Libya, and in some parts of Algeria. Sometimes thousands of Jews were deported from Europe to serve in slave labor camps in the Sahara, in Arab lands. So there's a mix of Jews, European Jews, Jews from Arab lands who suffered, but the total number is over 100 that have now been recognized by the German government. One of the small measures of pride, actually it's a great measure of pride, my contribution was modest, one of the great measures of pride from my research was to help contribute to this effort through some of my findings that convinced the German government to provide compensation to some of the Jewish survivors of these camps.
You know, you point out that there were labor camps in northern Africa, even though they were not death camps. I was not aware of that. At the same time, I've seen the movie Casablanca a lot. You point out a scene in Casablanca in which labor camps are referred to that I have to say went right past my attention every time I've seen it. Do you want to describe that scene?
It went past my attention the first dozen times I saw the movie, too, until it finally dawned on me as I was watching it for the umpteenth time that Major Strasser warns Ilse that it would be better for her husband to give himself up and go back to Paris, or else, he says, I will put him in a concentration camp here. And the critical word is here. He meant a concentration camp in Morocco. And, I mean, there's a lot of technical flaws in Casablanca, but that one was absolutely right. And one has to remember, Casablanca actually came out in December 42, only 1 month after the Allied invasion of North Africa, and they knew it, and they understood it, and this was well known at the time. And that's really, really why I subtitle my book Lost Stories, not Unknown Stories, because there was a time when people knew about these and talked about them.
Now, you described some of the laws that were put into effect in North African countries during World War II that limited the rights of Jews, stripped some Jews of their citizenship. You say that a lot of Jews in that part of the world were already second-class citizens?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the relationship between Jews and Arabs in Arab countries historically. It is absolutely true that you were better off being a Jew living in an Arab or Muslim land historically than being a Jew being born in a Christian land. Jews of Christian lands suffered the Inquisition, being burned at the stake, the pogroms, the massacre of York. One never had any of that in Arab lands, a very different experience. So relatively, you were better off in Arab and Muslim lands. Objectively speaking, life for Jews in Arab lands wasn't itself a rose garden. You were a dhimmi. You were, which is a dhimmi is a Muslim religious term which referred to non-Muslim people of the book, non-Muslim believers who had a different rank, a different status in society than Muslims themselves. You paid special taxes. You were subject to special laws, special restrictions on where you could live, what you could do as an occupation. It was difficult, sometimes very difficult. So relative to the Jews of Christendom, you were much better off. Of course, you didn't know that if you only grew up and lived in these countries.
Robert Satloff speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Robert Satloff. His book about the reach of the Holocaust into Arab lands, Among the Righteous, is now out in paperback.
Let's get to some of the stories that you uncovered about Arabs who help protect or save Jews during World War II in Arab lands. First of all, you say that there were Arab guards in camps who intentionally disobeyed orders to help protect Jews.
Well, there are some testimonies from some Jewish survivors of these camps that at times the torture or the orders coming from the fascist commandants, usually French legionnaires, were so egregious, so inhumane that some of them did what they could to undermine the orders or not implement them. There is one example of a testimony where Arab guards willfully shot their weapons away from Jews who they were ordered to shoot on. Or sometimes there were Arab guards who were especially kind to Jews who were suffering at the hands of torture. And the torture there, in some cases, rivaled the torture of some of the camps in Europe. So we do have these testimonies from some of the Jewish survivors.
You describe Algiers as being the setting for one of the war's most remarkable episodes of Arab solidarity with Jews. What happened there?
Vichy France tried to win as much support among the local Arab population for its policies as it could, and it tried to bribe local Arabs. And one way it tried to bribe them was to invite Arabs to serve as custodians of Jewish property, confiscated property, shops, stores, factories that Vichy took from Jewish property owners, and they offered Arabs the opportunity to run these, and it was make quite a nice, tidy profit. Then one Friday in 1941, all of the mosque preachers in Algiers issued a khutbah, a mosque speech, on the same Friday in which they said it was forbidden for any believer to take the bribe from Vichy. And the remarkable thing isn't just that the mosque preachers, the imams, all issued that order. The really remarkable thing is that not a single Arab took the bribe. Not a single one broke with the edict. And the Jews of Algiers remembered this. The leaders of the Jewish community said, you know, it wasn't their battle, but still they understood and were fraternal, and they remembered. And I think that is a great story of solidarity at a time of war.
Another story from Algiers was about a Muslim leader who resisted and urged people to resist any efforts to create a Jewish pogrom.
Yes, there were Muslim religious leaders in Algiers in the early 1940s, late 1930s, who, although the Vichy and Nazi anti-Semitism was targeted first toward Jews, they understood that Arabs were only slightly lower on the ladder of peoples that would be the object of that persecution. And if, you know, first the Jews went, targeting the Arabs wouldn't be too far behind. This wasn't widely accepted. There were some Arabs who did welcome the coming of the fascists, but especially among a group of liberal Muslim religious leaders and part of the Algerian nationalist movement, they said, no, we shouldn't let this happen to Jews, because first go the Jews and then go the Arabs.
You also visited the home of Mohamed Chaniq, who was the prime minister of Tunis during the German occupation. What did you find out there?
Well, Mohamed Chaniq was a philo-Semite. Many of his business partners were Jews. Many of his friends were Jews. And there's some really compelling stories that he did what he could to help save Jews during the German occupation. And so at one point, I wanted to find out more about him. And so I gathered together his family, his children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, etc. They all met at the family home. And I went to see them to see if they could provide me more stories, more evidence. And while they were very polite and welcoming, this was the first experience of mine where I found that they were really not interested in learning about the wonderful deeds that their father and grandfather had performed. And I guess I was a bit naive. I had thought that these sorts of exploits, these great humanitarian exploits, would be welcome to learn about. They were very, as I said, very polite, but I'm quite sure that they were pleased when I left, and they were very happy to show me the door.
You think that they weren't that enthusiastic about the idea that their father and grandfather had helped rescue Jews?
Well, one of the phenomena that I've that I've witnessed in the last couple of years as I've gone around talking to various children and grandchildren of these rescuers is a very mixed reaction. And sometimes they're very honest. You know, sometimes children and grandchildren will say, what my grandfather or father did half a century ago was wonderful then, but politics makes it very difficult for me to touch the story now. And this has to do with this very sad reality that somehow over the last 50 years, in many parts of the Middle East, many parts of Arab societies, it became toxic to celebrate stories of Arabs who saved Jews. And even though, you know, the politics, this is before the State of Israel, there's certainly no political implication here, but still the politics has become so toxic that for many of them it's very difficult to embrace, at least in a public way.
Now, one of the really interesting documents you found, you actually got in France from a mosque there. And this is a document that showed that a mosque had provided certificates of Muslim identity to Jews so that Jews could pass as Muslims and not be endangered.
Yes, this is a fascinating story because it occurred right in the heart of Europe, right under the German occupation, when Vichy is control and when the Germans are in Paris. And the story concerns the great mosque of Paris, the foremost Muslim institution in all of Europe. Its head was an Algerian by birth named Si Kadour Ben Gabrit. And there is compelling evidence that Si Kadour Ben Gabrit saved up to 100 Jews in a very clever fashion by providing them with certificates of Muslim identity, false identity papers, birth certificates, marriage certificates, saying that this person is Muslim. And with that, they could evade arrest and deportation. He even went so far in one episode to help save a certain famous Jewish singer, a man by the name of Simon Halali, by inscribing the name of Halali's grandfather on a tombstone in the Muslim cemetery outside Paris, so that when the Germans came for Halali, he was able to say, but wait a minute, look at my grandfather's name on that tombstone. I'm really a Muslim. Halali just died a couple of years ago, and that anecdote was mentioned in all of his obituaries. And when I was in Paris a little more than a year ago, the current rector of the mosque handed me a document from French archives which showed that the Germans had even brought in his predecessor, Ben Gabrit, and scolded him and warned him, stop providing the assistance that helps so many Jews. So I thought that was pretty compelling evidence.
You know, you write about two trends in Holocaust denial. One is the trend of, like, it never happened, it's just a lie. It's just a lie to justify the creation of Israel. But then there's what you describe as Holocaust minimization. Well, it's just an exaggeration. Not 6 million. You know, maybe some Jews died, but it certainly wasn't 6 million. Can you talk a little bit about Holocaust minimization as a trend?
Yeah, actually, Terry, I think there's three different categories.
Mm-hmm.
On one end of the spectrum, there's denial. It's a myth. It didn't happen. At the far other end of the spectrum, there's not denial, but there's celebration. Yes, it happened, and it was good. And the only bad thing about it is that Hitler didn't finish the job. You also see this written in some regrettably mainstream newspapers in Arab countries. But the vast amount of people, I think, have the third view, which is relativism or minimization, which is, well, it was nothing special. We don't know actually how many died. Was it 80,000? 600,000, 6 million. This is almost exactly what the president of Syria told Charlie Rose several months ago. I don't know how many died and it doesn't really matter. This is what the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, wrote his doctoral dissertation on 30 years ago in the Soviet Union when he said, look, the numbers are open to dispute. All of this is really an effort to delegitimize Israel, where if there's nothing uniquely special, if this wasn't the most effective effort to exterminate an entire people in human history, if there's nothing uniquely special about this, then there's no need for a unique remedy, which is how many Arabs view the creation of Israel. And I think that's why Holocaust relativism, the idea that no, we don't need a special word, genocide, a special word that was created just for the Holocaust. We don't need these special words because, okay, bad things happen over time. They've happened before and they'll happen again. But in fact, the world recognizes that the Holocaust was a uniquely depraved moment in human history for which we had to create new words to describe the enormity of the depravity.
Robert Satloff, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Satloff speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. Satloff is executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His book about the reach of the Holocaust into Arab lands, Among the Righteous, is now out in paperback. Last January, a Tunisian named Khaled Abdul Wahab was formally nominated by Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial as the first Arab to be recognized for saving Jews during the war. The nomination is presently under final review. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery, one of several socially active food cooperatives. Details are at go.coop, that's go.coop. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children. On the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor George Clooney. His new movie, Michael Clayton, opens today. Also, David Edelstein reviews the movie, and Ken Tucker reviews Is It News, the first solo album by Texas blues and rock and roll man Doyle Bramhall. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Doyle Bramhall has been making Texas blues and rock and roll since the 60s. His band, the Chessmen, once opened for Jimi Hendrix. Later, Bramhall was a drummer in Stevie Ray Vaughan's band, and the two wrote hits for Vaughan that included The House is Rockin' and Tightrope. Now, Bramhall has released his first solo album of original material called Is It News? Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. Here's the title track.
True, when you say you're home by yourself. Maybe it's because Doyle Bramhall is a drummer, a position in any band that, by helping to provide backbone rhythm, frequently instills in the musician a comfortable discretion, a willingness to remain part of the ensemble. There are exceptions, of course, ranging from Buddy Rich to Keith Moon, but as a frontman, Doyle Bramhall is definitely and disarmingly a team player. The closest he gets to showboating is on the song called Big, in which his drums boom thunderously and his hoarse yowl takes on a boastful assertion. More often, however, Bramhall mines the unhappiness of the blues for his best music. Born in Dallas, coming of musical age in the Texas bohemia of Austin, Bramhall is open to all sorts of music, including the New Orleans shuffle he applies to Tortured Soul. It's an elegantly trenchant summation of what it feels like to verge on and to resist despair.
Walking down this lonely street, all I have's a tortured soul.
Yes, it's when Bramhall embraces the loneliness in himself and others and constructs melodies that require the sharp snap of his drums to cut off mere self-pity and a willingness to believe that others can be as miserable as he can be that he achieves his best music.
I don't usually have much use for white blues, even that of Bramhall's former employer and collaborator, Stevie Ray Vaughan. That's probably because too many white bluesmen emulate the superiority of the black masters of their genre to such an extent that their own identities become blurry. This is not true of Bramhall, who pounds his drums with a propulsive melancholy, who sings with plaintiveness, his decades of music making giving him both gravity and a fleet assurance that anyone he loves, whether it's a woman or his audience, is in good, strong, calloused hands.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Is It News? From Doyle Bramhall. Coming up, George Clooney. This is Fresh Air. Our next guest, George Clooney, has a new movie out today, Michael Clayton, in which he plays an attorney at a high-priced, low-ethics law firm. Clooney rose to stardom in the TV series ER. His father, Nick Clooney, was a TV newsman, which helped provide some of the inspiration for his son's film Good Night and Good Luck, the story of CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow. Clooney's aunt, Rosemary Clooney, was a famous singer of standards and popular tunes. Terry spoke with George Clooney in 2005 and asked what his aunt's music meant to him.
What did her music mean to you when you were growing up? It was not your generation.
No, but I was one of those weird kids, you know. I was listening to...
It wasn't my generation either.
No, that's right. Well, I was listening to Led Zeppelin and I was listening to Nat Cole. You know, I had a very varied growing up because I was on the road with, you know, with them a lot, or I was always exposed to...
Were you
to...
on the road with Rosemary Clooney?
Yeah.
No, I mean with Led Zeppelin? Wait, who were you on the road
with? Oh, yeah, exactly. With Led Zeppelin. No, I was on the road. When I was 20, I was Rosemary's driver.
Oh, you know? Right. I see. Yeah.
So I was around that kind of music a lot.
Yeah.
So I got to appreciate Cole Porter and Johnny Mercer.
I
had a real appreciation of those guys. Sinatra and, you know, Nat King Cole especially, and Rosemary. And Rosemary was having, she was having her comeback at that point. And her comeback was something rather spectacular because she became the singer's singer. Singers adored her and would show up. So there was a great pride in being around her. So I was really exposed to that kind of music. I remember asking Rosemary why she's a better singer at 70 than she was at 21 because she couldn't hold the notes the way she could. She couldn't hit the notes the way. And she said, because I don't have to prove I can sing anymore. And I thought that was a good acting lesson, you know, was not having to show off anymore.
And I know exactly what she was talking about, too, because her voice was basically shot in the last couple of recordings she made. But her phrasing was so beautiful, and the emotion was so beautifully conveyed in it.
When you see her taking songs that are normally sort of up-tempoed, like Don't Fence Me In, or and bringing it down to like a quarter of the speed and singing, you know, Straighten Up and Fly Right. It's amazing.
You stayed with your aunt when you first got to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like she threw you out after a while.
Pretty much, yeah. I understand that. I would have thrown me out.
How come?
Well, I think at some point you don't need a 22-year-old kid hanging around in your house anymore. I'm sure I was a pain. At some point, I'm sure... You know, the idea of offering your nephew to come out and live with you is a nice gesture, but I think it comes back to haunt you after about a year, you know?
Yeah. Did you think you were talented when you started working? Did you think you actually had something?
I didn't really know whether I had any talent or not. I knew that I was, for the first time in my life, engaged. I was 20 years old, 21 years old, and didn't really have any great objectives. I wasn't going to be a great newsman. I'd studied journalism. I'd done a few news pieces, but I wasn't bright enough or curious enough to do news, especially on the level that my father was doing it, and I was certainly going to be compared to my father. And then I found acting, and I thought, well, this is something that at the very least I'm not going to be bored by. And I got into an acting class pretty quickly, and I started working with working actors. And, you know, there's an assumption before you actually become part of the acting community that people who work are good actors and people who don't are bad actors. It's just sort of an assumption. And what you realized was you'd be doing a scene and you'd be holding your own with someone who's making a very good living acting. You'd realize that there's a possibility that you can actually do this for a living. So it was a long process of figuring out whether or not I was any good at it. And it's still a long process of figuring that out.
Well, when you got ER, that certainly must have changed your life a lot. I mean, suddenly you were a star, and people become so close to you when you're on TV every week.
Yeah.
There's this kind of bonding that I think people go through.
It's an unusual experience because it's not like being a movie star. You haven't paid $10 and you're 30 feet high and you've made it a date. You know, you've been in their homes every Thursday, so... You know, the truth is I'm a product of a great amount of luck. I create some of that luck because, you know, I did 13 pilots and I did 8 television series before that. But the simple truth is, had I done that exact same show and that exact same role and we were on Friday night instead of Thursday night at 10, I don't have a film career and I'm not sitting here with you. It requires that kind of luck. The show would never have been as popular on a Friday night as it was on a Thursday night.
You knew something about fame. You know, your father was on TV. Rosemary Clooney, your aunt, was incredibly famous. But what surprised you most when it happened to you? What were you unprepared for?
Well, it's a funny thing. There isn't a real fame school that you can go to and learn, you know. I had probably, if there was anybody, there's, you haven't met many people better prepared for it, because I had the great vision of watching, especially with Rosemary, how big you can get and how quickly it can be taken away. Mm-hmm. And it's not like Rosemary became less of a singer in that period of time, which showed me that it has very little to do with you. And you still have that. I still have the idea that that goes away at some point, as it does, sooner or later. And when it does, that's why you direct and you write and you try to have other coals in the fire. But the things that you aren't prepared for are the trade-offs. No one wants to hear you complain about them, so you don't complain about them. But I would say that the significant loss of privacy is interesting.
One of the things you've done was try to take on one of the tabloid news shows, mm-hmm. Hard Copy. What provoked you to take a stand and try to tone down the aggressiveness with which the tabloid shows were coming after stars?
Well, I thought it was, I've always dealt with things because I'm the son of a journalist. I thought I had a journalistic argument, which I did, which was that if, it all started in sort of a silly moment. I was sitting eating dinner with a girl, and somebody had a video camera on the table next to us, and they propped it up on a cork and videotaped it. And the next night, that conversation that I was having with this girl in private at a restaurant was on Hard Copy. And I said, okay, fair enough. I'm going to say you're allowed to do that, even though I think it is an infringement of privacy. Let's just say I'm a public figure, so fair enough. Everything's fair game. However, somebody took that video and Hard Copy bought it. And Hard Copy was owned by Paramount, who also owned
Entertainment Tonight.
So I called up Entertainment Tonight and I said, listen, I'm not going to do any more of your shows, which you use me to make money and then use that money to buy these videos from these guys. That seems like a fair argument. And a guy named Frank Kelly, who was running the place at the time, said, I'll make you a deal. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, the deal is you'll never appear on Hard Copy if you just drop this right now. And I said, put it in writing. And he did, on Paramount letterhead. Now, this was right when they were putting the ratings on TV, and they thought it was going to be a big deal, you know, TV, PG, and stuff like that. And they thought it was actually going to be much bigger than it was. And everyone was trying to get a news rating, which meant there was a no rating. And Hard Copy was battling heavily to be a news show, which, of course, it isn't. It wasn't. It was an entertainment show. Battling, you know, it was Inside Edition with Bill O'Reilly, in fact, A Current Affair, Hard Copy, American Journal. Those shows were all sort of entertainment shows. So I had this piece of paper that said, we agree that you will never appear on our news show, Hard Copy. About 6 months later, there was this innocuous story, because it couldn't have been, if it was a explosive story, it would have just been me trying to defend myself for the story. It had to be an innocuous story. It was just a shot of me walking down the street with my girlfriend. But it was on Hard Copy. So I called, I sent the letter around, and I said, first of all, you broke your promise, but more important than that is I'm not sure you're allowed to call yourself a news organization and make this promise. I'm fairly sure you can't, in fact. And it ended up on the front page of a lot of newspapers, and they called it a smoking gun. And it ended up being sort of a fun fight. It was all journalistic fight.
When you were, I think, around 13, tell me if I'm wrong with the age, you got for about a year something called Bell's Palsy.
Yes.
And you could describe what it is for a second.
Well, Bell's, they're not quite sure what causes it. They think it's a inner ear virus. It's certainly something you catch. Most people, when you're kids, usually takes about 6 months to go away. Sometimes people have it when they're older and it doesn't last quite as long. About 90% of the time it gets better, but it's complete paralysis in half of your face. Numb, complete, you know, eye patch, the whole thing.
So you were that way for about a year?
About 9 months, yeah.
Terrifying.
Well, when it first happened, because I'd just seen the movie Pride of the Yankees with Lou Gehrig, and he'd had Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, he came down at the end of the movie. And I remember I was sitting in church with my mom and dad, and my tongue was numb, and the side of my face was numb. I was just starting high school, you know. It's not a great time for that anyway. And we went to Frisch's Big Boy, which is where you go to, you know, like Bob's Big Boy. It's one of these fast food restaurants where we would go after church. And I was drinking, and the milk was pouring out of the side of my mouth. And I thought, well, I've got Lou Gehrig's disease, and I'm going to die. And you realize fairly quickly that it was Bell's palsy after I got into a doctor.
Then that naturally goes away on its own?
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, the reason why I ask is I've noticed that a lot of artists, writers, actors were disabled and sidelined during a part of their childhood by some kind of, you know, illness or another. And that they were forced to kind of stop doing certain activities and spend more time alone in their bedroom doing whatever you do when you're a kid alone in your room. Did the Bell's palsy put you through a period like that? And did it change you at all? Did it make you...
Sure. Well, what it does is, it's a funny thing, but, you know, you got to remember that up until I was 13 years old, we moved. I went to 5 different grade schools. We moved a lot because my dad had a lot of different jobs. So going from, you actually develop either a good personality about being around people, or my sister had a tougher time with it. You're either comfortable or you're not about being around people. It makes it much more difficult when suddenly half your face is paralyzed and you're going into high school.
Yeah.
So what you become is the joker. It's probably a great thing that it happened to me, because it forced me to engage in a series of making fun of myself. And I think that's an important part of – it's an important part of being famous, by the way, which is, you know, you got to get yourself first. You have to – you know, the practical jokes have to be aimed at you. You have to be able to make fun of yourself a lot. I think that that's been one of the issues with some of the some of the liberal bend. Some of my friends even at times that take up the fight against Bush is that they lack some humor. And because of that, it comes off as preaching. And I think that there's other ways of doing it. You know, the traitor issue is a perfect example. I'll give you the best example is, there was this magazine cover and it had, Sean Penn and Michael Moore and myself and Barbara Streisand and Susan Sarandon and Tim Robinson. It had a picture, it was not the Globe, but it was one of those magazines that said traitor across our chest. And I got a call from one of these actors, not one of them, but another actor who I will keep nameless. But they called me and said, who was also on the cover, and called up and said, we have to hold a press conference and say that this is McCarthyism. This is, you know, you can't do this. And I said, look, you can't be talking about freedom of speech, which is what we're talking about, being allowed to say what we want, and then say, but don't say bad things about me. You got to take your hits. I said, let me handle it. Let me do one. And they said, okay. So I took that same cover of the magazine with the same pictures of us on it, and I found other people who were speaking out about the war, the Pope, Pat Buchanan, Bob Novak, Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter. I put them also on that, with traitor right across the Pope's chest. And I sent it to 800 news outlets anonymously with a thing underneath it that said, paid for by the citizens for a free Iraq. You know, I'm for a free Iraq. Folded up and sent it out anonymously and waited. And CBS and Entertainment Tonight eventually picked it up, and they called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I was waiting for that.
Was your name on it? Did they know it was from you?
No, it was completely anonymous. Uh-huh. So when they sent it out, my quote, Entertainment Tonight called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And my quote was, the Pope and I can take it, but don't pick on Pat Buchanan. And the trick was, to me, the idea was, you got to do this with some humor. I mean, I remember Michael Moore called me up and he said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I said, that's me, Michael. I did that. And he goes, oh, okay, good. So the trick to me was that there had to be some humor to this, because we got to sort of, and you got to take the hits yourself a little bit.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
That was fun.
George Clooney speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. His new movie, Michael Clayton, opens today. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the film. This is Fresh Air. George Clooney's character in his new film, Michael Clayton, describes himself as a janitor. He's a high-priced New York lawyer who's paid to clean up other people's messes. Film critic David Edelstein says that Michael Clayton is an entertaining film that's also a morality tale, centering on the hero's conscience. Here's his review.
The level of secrecy in the current administration has helped create the ripest environment for paranoid conspiracy movies since the Watergate era, and the genre's mascot is surely George Clooney. Syriana put international terrorism in a Noam Chomskyite context as revenge for the West's economic exploitation. In promoting Good Night and Good Luck, Clooney drew comparisons between the Army-McCarthy hearings and the present climate for dissent. Even The Good German, set in the 40s, centered on dark U.S. government machinations under the movie-ish glamour. Clooney's new film, Michael Clayton, is set in a world where multinational corporations retain high-priced lobbyists and law firms to ensure they have zero government oversight, and where the last line of defense is the conscience of the individual. It's a conversion melodrama, and in its outlines, routine, but it's sensationally well done. Clooney's Michael Clayton is an attorney who's kept in the shadows of a huge law firm, where he works as a fixer, the guy who, behind the scenes, cleans up messes for the biggest clients. After a confusing prologue with multiple lines of action and an exploding car, so you know it's all going to turn deadly, the movie flashes back 3 days. Clayton is massively in debt from a failed restaurant venture and can't afford to turn down an unsavory new assignment to muzzle his friend Arthur, one of the firm's partners. Arthur is normally an attack dog, but has gone off his meds and cracked under the strain of doing bad things for bad people, in this case, for a vast agribusiness fighting a multi-billion dollar class action suit, charging it with knowingly marketing a carcinogenic weed killer. Tom Wilkinson plays Arthur, and while it's hard to imagine him as a Doberman in court, he's a phenomenal basket case, prodigiously twitchy. In a holding cell, after he melted down at a deposition, he explains to Clayton his commitment to a young female plaintiff.
They killed them, Michael. Those small farms, the family farms. Did you meet Anna?
No.
Oh, you gotta see her. You gotta talk to her. She's a miracle, Michael. She's God's perfect little creature. And for $50 million in fees, I've spent 12% of my life destroying perfect Anna and her dead parents and her dying brother.
When was the last time you took one of these?
No, I'm not losing this. Everything is now finally significant. The world is a beautiful and radiant place. I'm not trading that for this.
If it's real, the pill won't kill it.
I have blood on my hands.
You are the senior litigating partner of one of the largest, most respected law firms in the world. You are a legend.
I'm an accomplice!
You're a manic depressive.
I am Shiva, the god of death.
Let's get out of Milwaukee. We'll talk about it.
What keeps Arthur's righteous speeches and the movie from seeming sanctimonious is that they're part gibberish and that he totes around bizarre props, like a bag with more than a dozen large baguettes. He can also reel off statutes hilariously to keep from being involuntarily committed. But the movie turns serious when the agribusiness's new chief legal counsel, played by Tilda Swinton, decides to go beyond Michael Clayton's gentle treatment of Arthur. I know people who find Swinton's character a problem in a feminist backlash way, an ambitious woman attempting to pattern herself on ruthless male bosses. But I found her fascinating. Early on, the film cuts between her anxious rehearsal before the mirror of her first presentation to company executives and the smooth presentation itself, back and forth, so that you're sensitized to the tremulousness under her crisp efficiency. You know she's human and not an automaton, which is why her moral dilemma is so shocking. The writer and director of Michael Clayton is Tony Gilroy, who wrote all three of Matt Damon's Jason Bourne films. But this is not one of those jittery motion sickness pictures that accelerate around every narrative curve. It holds to a measured beat, to the point where you feel a growing impatience, a good impatience, the kind that keeps you riveted. Maybe that's why the climax, a dialogue in which no voice is raised, is so smashingly cathartic, and why the denouement that follows, the last shot of the film, is so hauntingly strange and sad. Clooney is as good as he's ever been. He uses his glamour as a mask, internalizing everything. Only a faint touch of glibness clues you in to Clayton's disgust with what he does and the people with whom he does it. The real hook of Michael Clayton is watching it dawn on him that while whistleblowing can mean death, being a cog in an infernal machine is not a design for living.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirschfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Husbandry, Sex, Love, and Dirty Laundry, Inside the Minds of Married Men by Stephen Fried. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Shalom Auslander about what's been described as his hilarious and biting memoir of growing up in an Orthodox Jewish family and growing away from it. Also, A.J. Jacobs tells us about his attempt to follow the edicts of the Bible as literally as possible. It's the subject of his book, The Year of Living Biblically. Join us for the next Fresh Air.